Hello, this time on SITREP.
We will spend a minimum of 10% of the Ministry of Defence's equipment budget on new novel technologies, including drones and AI-enabled technology.
The UK, like many others, is betting big on drones for the future of warfare, from tiny handheld devices to multi-million dollar missile delivery systems and boats too. Ukraine has shown military drone technology truly coming of age. But the army has also just demonstrated how swarms of drones can be taken down with nothing more than radio waves. It's clear drones have changed how war is fought right now, but how do we make best use of them? And are they also the future of warfare, or just one small step in a military technology race?
SITREP
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Well, one of the reasons we wanted to talk drones this time is because of a couple of reasonably long posts on X by the Defence People and Veterans Minister, Al Carnes. They set out his thoughts on how drones have changed the character of conflict and how the UK should respond. We've shared those posts on X at BFBS SITREP if you want to take a look for yourself, and we will talk through the interesting details in a bit. Mike, I said that drones have come of age in the Ukraine war, but you can trace their evolution back through things like flying bombs used in World War II and even incendiary balloons in the mid-1800s.
Oh, yes. The incendiary balloons. You know, the Montgolfier brothers, the two people who are credited with the first hot air balloon. What, the Montgolfier, or at least one of them, suggested that they be used against the British during the French Revolutionary Wars. And I think the first use of incendiary balloons was in the Italian War against the Wars for Independence against Austria. And certainly the British used types of balloons, even in the Second World War, drifting over German territory. They used them to try to foul power lines and pylons and so on. But of course, we think of the first drone that we would all recognise is the V1, the Doodlebug, which is a pilotless aircraft, you know, and it would fly towards London until its engine cut out, and then it would just drop with its explosives. So there's plenty of background to drones, but what we're interested in, as with all military innovations, is really, you know, when they become available in a way that you know, they can be guided, they're cheap enough to produce, they can be used in a different way. It's always the employment of the thing rather than the thing itself, which is interesting. And the way they've been employed cheaply at high numbers with guidance behind them, that puts us on the edge of a really big revolution on the battlefield. That's where we are now. We're on the edge of an even bigger revolution with AI being able to direct swarms of drones to do all sorts of things. We're on the edge of that now.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time, isn't it? And back in the Iraq and Afghanistan era, you and I would have conversations about Britain and America using drones and be referring to small planes carrying deadly missiles and piloted remotely from thousands of miles away. And we'd sometimes talk about how much smaller and cheaper drones could eventually come into the mix. That has become the reality and the game changer in Ukraine, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it often takes a war or a conflict to bring about what you and I could talk about in theory. It's, you know, warfare is the driver for implementing ideas which are kicking around and which suddenly become a necessity. And there you are. If it wasn't for the Ukrainian war, drones would still be, you know, halfway between what we talked about during the Iraq and Afghanistan operations and where they're going to be in about 10 years' time.
Well, let's bring in Dr. Keith Deer, former RAF intelligence officer, former expert advisor to the Prime Minister on science, technology and modernising defence, and founder of the AI strategy startup Cassie. Keith, great to see you on SITREP. Thanks for coming. Big picture first thought. How transformative has drone technology been for militaries in the last few years? Is it revolutionary or evolutionary?
Well, firstly, thanks, Kate, for inviting me on today. I think it's fair to say where we are now is evolutionary, but where we are is also on the brink of that revolution. So it was 2011 when Mark Andreessen, the investor at Andreessen Horowitz, told us that software was eating the world. It's only really today that software has started to eat defence in the way that it's eaten every other industry before. You know, I talk to the CEOs of some of the leading companies in the world. Every single company today will tell you it's a software company first that just happens to be in banking. It's a software company first that just happens to be in manufacturing. Defence is only just reaching that point. And much of the hardware, as Mike says, is not that revolutionary, but the software on it is really changing very, very quickly and enabling the kind of autonomy we're seeing the kind of operations we're seeing and the scale that we haven't had before. So we're only just getting the software revolution in defence. The AI revolution has really not begun at all. And I think there's very little AI guiding those drones that we're talking about in Ukraine at the moment. And I think when that starts to happen, that's when we get the true revolution in warfare.
Well, let's explore the thoughts shared by Defence Minister Al Khan on X. Some of the key points from his post are, for the first time since World War One, artillery is not the biggest cause of casualties, it's drones. Most deep strikes are with drones, dumb hardware paired with increasingly sophisticated software. We therefore need a mix of mass-produced drones coupled with high-end sophisticated weapons. And we need to change our tactics, techniques and procedures to include the use of mass drones and, of course, train accordingly. Keith, why have drones overtaken artillery?
Well, one of the reasons is persistence. So once you've got tens of thousands of drones overhead, I mean, even just hundreds of drones overhead, you can't move. You can't move out of your trench. You can't move anywhere without being seen and being killed. And that's why we're seeing the very rapid casualties. It becomes very hard to, in military terms, to concentrate mass. So if you think of that, one of the things that concentration is a fundamental principle of war. You need to bring your sort of tanks together, if you like, to punch through the enemy lines. Well, you can't do that because as soon as you start to assemble, that grouping of tanks gets spotted by one drone and killed by another. So thousands of drones means that you might well have control of the air above 10,000 feet, which is kind of what we plan for. But if there are thousands of drones below it, stopping your soldiers from and your vehicles from moving, then really you can't fight the way in which you'd intended to. And you get very static front lines, which is what we have seen. And that is what artillery did in World War One. It's what drones are doing today in Ukraine and would likely do to us also.
Mike, do you want to add to that?
No, I was interested in what Keith said about 10,000 feet. I've always argued that below 5,000 feet is the drone zone, and you say 10,000 feet. I'm just interested. You think it is 10,000 feet now is the drone zone, and above that is air power in the traditional sense. Below that is the drone zone.
Well, I think, again, we're talking about today and tomorrow. Give it 2 or 3 years at the absolute most, and I think everything's automated everywhere. That may be something we explore later. But I think, yes, things like acoustic sensors have pushed drones to higher altitude in order to avoid those acoustic sensors. So you've got this, as our GATS Red Queen race, you run faster and faster just to stay in the same place with attack and defence constantly countering each other. I think defensive techniques like acoustic sensors have pushed drones up to higher altitudes, and you've also got some of the ISR drones that are operating at those higher altitudes as well. So both.
And Keith, are we talking about off-the-shelf drones having explosives MacGyvered onto them, or are bespoke weaponized small drones now a big-scale reality?
It's still absolutely both. There's still an awful lot of the kind of Heath Robinson cobbling together of what you need. There is a growing number of bespoke tailored designs. One of the interesting things is that we can do much more, and the defence customer, if you like, those on the front lines are constantly asking people to strip back capabilities, to remove capabilities from the drones, to keep the costs right down. I think one of the ways in which we were led astray after the Cold War was focusing much more on effectiveness, like how can we build ever more effective systems, which is where we end up with exquisite and expensive
Yes.
systems, and not on efficiency. Like what is the most efficient way? I wrote an article last year on 5 provocations on future warfare, where we described how defence needs to move to a dollar cost, dollar damage model. You know, really thinking hard about how every single dollar that it spends on a capability, how many more dollars damage does it inflict on the adversary? And I think that's the world we are in now, but it's still too much of that is being done kind of implicitly rather than explicitly. I would like to see planning based much more thoroughly on like, okay, what's the minimum we can spend to cause the maximum amount of damage?
And Mike, how much have drones affected the relevance of artillery?
Oh, tremendously. I mean, artillery is still very, very important. And the reason that the Ukrainians, of course, have gone so far into drones is because they're short of artillery. If they had the number of shells that they really needed, they wouldn't have pushed quite so hard or so inventively to use drones instead of artillery. But what they've shown is that drones, I think, as Keith was saying earlier on, have got some real advantages over artillery because they can dodge around and they loiter. I mean, artillery shells don't loiter. And so, you know, the need, as the minister said, is for a mix, of course. But I don't think anybody quite anticipated how cheap, small, civil, civilian-based drones can do what artillery shells can do, and then something else as well. And that's been a bit of an eye-opener, to be honest, as the Ukraine war has developed.
Keith, you're nodding away throughout that.
Well, I think I was nodding away because I was thinking, well, it's complementary, not just in the sense of high-low capability, but the drones are absolutely a complement to artillery as well. Like, having that persistence means that you can instantly kind of much more accurately target your artillery if you have sufficient shells. So they work in tandem. You know, if you think about the evolution of air power, really, artillery spotting was one of the very first roles of air power. And you see sort of similar evolution of air power today, uncrewed air power today, that we saw through crewed air power, where it starts seeing over the other side of the hill, and then it starts dropping bombs. Like, you can think of the early days of literally throwing bombs out the side of a biplane, and onwards from there. So we're seeing a very similar evolution of air power, and that it starts and remains, I think, a complement to artillery rather than an alternative to it.
And you know, Kate, there is something really genuinely new, I think, that's come out only in the last couple of years from the Russian side and the Ukrainian side in Ukraine about this, is that traditionally with artillery, you know, most soldiers say, well, it's a calculated risk. You take your chances moving around the battlefield as to whether artillery can get you. So you accept the risks. But now soldiers are genuinely really scared of moving around because they know they can be spotted and targeted much more accurately than with artillery, much more personally. And that sense of minute-to-minute fear of being on the forward edge of the battle area is something that I've not known of until now. And I think that fear is something that we are only just beginning to understand the effect of that on the way forces fight.
Yeah, that goes back to what Keith was saying earlier about soldiers being pinned down in their trenches, doesn't it? If we look at the training aspect here, the Times has reported that Ukrainian drone instructors have come to Britain as part of Operation Interflex and are sharing what they've learned in this war. Denmark has said publicly that it's going to send troops for drone training in Western Ukraine. Mike, how much can we learn from their experiences?
Oh, huge amount. I mean, these are the people who are close to the battle edge, the battle area. They're the ones, and the Ukrainians are the ones who are fighting. I think we all accepted that once we started training Ukrainian soldiers, within a few months, they'd be teaching us all sorts of things. And that process of mutual training and learning, I think, is going on. And one of the areas in which we've got an awful lot to learn is exactly what we're just talking about, how to operate on the battlefield in a way that where a battlefield is populated by a big group of drones, or drones are, you know, ubiquitous on the battlefield. That changes the dynamics of people moving around.
Keith, what drones do the UK armed forces have at the moment?
Well, I mean, we have Watchkeeper and Protector and Reaper. These are drones principally designed for the era of counterinsurgency, where there was nothing going to shoot those aircraft down. There were limited surface-to-air missile capabilities, limited in their altitude, limited, you know, old generation surface-to-air missiles. They're very vulnerable in the kind of war that Ukraine is fighting, to surface-to-air missile systems, to anti-aircraft artillery systems, and sometimes even to air-to-air kills. So most of our drones are designed for that era. We have some early stage experimentation with the kind of smaller drones that Ukraine is operating, but nothing at a sort of really meaningful scale at the moment. It's all experimentation rather than adoption. There are reasons why that's not a bad idea. The drone development time frame in Ukraine was 6 weeks and is increasingly getting shorter and shorter. So buying a million drones, for example, tomorrow for the UK inventory, well, they'd all be out of date a week later, not just the software, but increasingly the hardware is changing. So you need to think about how you procure these things in a different way. So whilst there is a direct and not so much implied as explicit criticism of the slowness of UK adoption in what I say, there's also an acknowledgement that the answer doesn't mean we must buy a million drones tomorrow. We need to think much more about how we can contract for drones that consistently develop and that we can manufacture at that kind of scale very quickly if we need to.
And Mike, how much have big drones been part of the Ukraine war?
Well, they were at the beginning. I mean, the Bayraktar drones, the Turkish drones, which were, you know, established a sort of real niche for themselves as tank busters. And the Bayraktar drone had been around for a long time. It had made a difference in the Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict in 2020. And that was when people in the West, I remember in the Ministry of Defence, they really sat up when they saw that Soviet-era tanks and Russian tanks were being taken out by very cheap Turkish drones used in conjunction with Israeli surveillance drones. And when the Ukrainian war started, we saw a lot more of that. And Bayraktar was one of the big names in the first year of the war. But increasingly, we've seen the war move to smaller and smaller drones, as well as drones getting bigger and doing the work of aircraft, but without the pilot. And there are all sorts of advantages in being able to fly aircraft without pilots. So we've seen that the development of some big drones, but in general, the bigger drones belong to the earlier part of the war. And it's the ability to swarm with smaller drones that has made the war what it is at the moment.
And another idea that has been discussed on X in the last few days is whether drones could replace attack helicopters. This came from a video that appeared to show a Russian attack helicopter being destroyed in a drone attack. Could drones, Keith, replace that kind of manned capability altogether?
I mean, yes, and they will. The future is will be fully uncrewed for air forces. We already have in the US Project Vista, we have F-16s dogfighting fully uncrewed in the US today. We had DARPA's Alpha dogfight trials before showing the performance, albeit in the simulator, but of how effective uncrewed systems could be. We need to remember we only have the generations of drones we have today because in 2010, Senator Warner of the House Armed Service Committee in the US mandated that by 2015, 50% of the US Air Force, US Army and US Navy's vehicles and aircraft had to be uncrewed. It forced the US Air Force and the other services into developing the systems that we see today. And I was serving with the US at the time. I can tell you there was massive, massive institutional resistance to that edict. And eventually they defeated it, which is why we don't have a 50% uncrewed Air Force today. We would if they hadn't been able to overcome and put bureaucratic obstacles in the way. So, and if you think about the speed of technological change at the moment, you know, Moore's law, I talked about software eating the world earlier, that's been driven by Moore's law. Moore's law is the doubling of compute capability every 18 months, doubling every 18 months. In AI at the moment, we're seeing a 10x increase in the cost effectiveness and performance of models every 10 months. And that's not slowing down, it's speeding up. So if you go back a few years when the first GPT OpenAI model was released, it was able to do coding tasks that took 30 seconds. It can now do tasks that take an hour. If it continues on its current trajectory, it will be completely autonomously completing tasks that take a whole month by the middle of next year. And it's incredible. And that kind of automating and rapid acceleration is why we won't have pilots in aircraft beyond 2030 at the latest.
Mike, some in the army would really not like to hear the idea that attack helicopters would be consigned to the past, and their concerns will at least in part be based on capability.
Yeah, and you know, these things are always a balance. And again, I mean, the effectiveness of drones as a vehicle is terrific, but there's also countermeasures, and there is a you know, new arms race developing. In if you can't stop drones swarming, you know, below, you know, like as Keith says, say 10,000 feet, certainly 5,000 feet, maybe you've got to try to find some sort of death ray that neutralizes them in some way. I mean, that there's a natural arms race in that respect. And of course, the army don't want to give up on the idea of attack helicopters, because if they can be, if they're survivable, they're extremely useful. And the army always wants close air support. I mean, it can never quite rely on no army can really rely on its air force for close air support for all sorts of reasons. There's never enough of it. And armies want their own close air support that they can command themselves of an air arm that can actually get above their own troops and towards the enemy troops or enemy installations to do the things that they need to do. So I understand the way the army feels about that, but it kind of depends upon whether there is a new development in the offing which can actually keep the skies safe for attack helicopters, even for short periods.
Mm. And that is a big question. What comes next? The minister's second post outlines a future where a division will be supported by hundreds of networked drones, which can provide imagery from across the entire battlefield while operator-controlled attack drones hunt and strike. We've not seen drones used at that scale in Ukraine. Is the technology there yet, Keith?
Yes, it's there. It's just not deployed. You look at how AI is revolutionising almost every field except defence. And the reason for that is the ambition and the investment that is going in elsewhere. So Demis Hassabis at DeepMind just last week was talking about curing most diseases in the next decade. He's not just talking about that. Things like AlphaFold for protein folding are proving that it's possible. But it costs money. It costs about £420 million a year for Google to maintain DeepMind. and to, in order to tackle those kind of tasks. And defence isn't spending anything like that, nor does it have anything like the same kind of ambitious approach to integrating AI. And when I say defence here, it's true of the UK, but it's also true of NATO. It's true in Ukraine. Like nobody is prioritising this in defence in the way that it is being prioritised elsewhere. And so we don't see the transformative effects. But to answer your question directly, Kate, is the technology there? The technology is there. We just need the investment and the ambition to make it happen.
And Mike, how far away is any military from being equipped and able to operate at that scale?
Well, closer than we were a couple of years ago. A lot of this, I think, will be dependent on how the defence review lands. I mean, how it comes out. I mean, what the reaction to it is, how the government takes whatever recommendations it's going to make. But certainly it's an intrinsic part of the Army's plan under Rowley Walker to increase its lethality, you know, to double its lethality in a few years and then treble its lethality just a few years after that. And so certainly the ambition is there. It is plausible that Britain might be deeply into this field within the next 4 or 5 years, but that needs commitment of the government, and it needs the funding, and it needs the determination that we are going to transform our forces, and particularly the army in this respect, in the directions that Keith is talking about.
Well, let's put in some cautionary notes now. Al Khan specifically points out lessons from Ukraine cannot necessarily be applied to other theatres. And I mentioned earlier that the army has just successfully trialled a device using radio waves to bring down a drone swarm. If we can do that, an enemy may well be able to do the same, Keith.
Well, there's a number of different things to answer to that. Firstly, you could have shielding in the drone. So the minute that that became effective, you would begin to have RF shielding and other shielding within the drones themselves to deny that capability. What Mike talks about, the constant arms race between attack and defence. If you deploy that capability, somebody will come up with a counter. The counter is pretty obvious in that particular case. Secondly, as with all air defences, that can't be deployed ubiquitously. So, for example, defending like the NATO's eastern border is a huge border. It's not going to be able to be defending it everywhere all at once. And so you might be able to do some point defence, but you wouldn't be able to defend everywhere. And thirdly, every single one of our modern aircraft is fly-by-wire. You know, pilots are no longer able to control that to keep it in the air. It only stays in the air because a computer is constantly stabilising the aircraft. If you can, as it were, fry the circuits and jam the drones, so you can fry the circuits and jam the drones with a crewed aircraft in exactly the same way. So many of the criticisms we raise against drones and the reasons why we say, well, they couldn't possibly continue on their trajectory are exactly the same things you could raise to say why air power won't be effective in the future. And so far, we've always been able to overcome those hurdles and defences, and I see no reason why it won't be the same with uncrewed systems.
And Keith, to your judgment, who is actually leading that arms race in attack and defence at the moment?
Well, it depends where we are in the world. I think right now that defence has the edge because of the large swarming drones pinning everybody down all along the front line, preventing either side from massing and being able to punch through the front lines. It seems to me right now in Ukraine, the answer to that question is the defence has the advantage. I don't think that's where this heads. I think the offence has the advantage, particularly if we were to have a much more naval-based conflict. I think at that point, the ability to concentrate naval drones would give the offence a much stronger advantage. But and that's why we see China investing in, for example, over 1 million drones last year and the kind of contracting approaches that I've talked about. So I think right now it's definitely the defensive, but I think where we go is much more rapid decisions, ability to concentrate large numbers of drones in time and space and punch through using uncrewed systems, and the offence will be back in the dominant again in the next war.
Mike, the ideas of transforming our air and land power around drones sound very appealing, but how big is the risk something else will transform the next war and make drones redundant?
Well, there are always those technological developments, and you're trying to hedge against them. But that's the point, that they, you know, weapons are not all invalidated all at once everywhere. And so you can imagine that if there are counter-drone technologies, they could be used, a bit like mine sweeping, actually. They could be used to open up a corridor in which drones can't operate or can't operate efficiently, and then you do something in that corridor, and that corridor might only be open for a matter of hours before it closes again. So it's never as it were, all over the battlefield all the time, or all over the operational area all the time. But there will be this constant competition. And that's why you have to keep up with the technologies, but you have to keep up with them in a way that's flexible enough that you don't commit yourself to a technology for 20 years' time, working backwards from. What we're trying to do now in the UK is adopt what is there now and keep refining it as we go, because it won't look in 20 years' time the way we might anticipate now. And one thing we can be certain of is that in 20 years' time, it'll need to do something else. So we've got to keep evolving it year by year, not sort of set out the requirement and then wait for 5 years before it arrives.
And what we've talked about so far has been drones providing air power to support land warfare. But as Keith just alluded to, Ukraine has also shown just how effective they can be at sea. Despite being without a functioning navy, it's managed to neutralise Russia's Black Sea Fleet, with a significant part of the work being done by uncrewed sea vehicles. A new £30 million package of drones for Ukraine has just been announced by the UK. And while details of what's in the package have not been released, the supplier Sios Aerospace is also one of the West's biggest manufacturers of uncrewed sea vehicles. I've been talking to the company's founder, Sam Vai, about what drones at sea can do.
We are quite a large producer of USVs for a number of different customers. And I think it's really driven from the fact that our USVs have a really high capability to low cost ratio. So, you know, they're not an exquisite product, they're more of an attritable product. And we can churn out the vehicles exceptionally quickly. So we can manufacture about 40 per month if required. And all of those obviously have high autonomy, swarming capabilities. They have high precision in GNSS denied environments, and obviously they have a strong, robust and resilient C2 command and control data link, if you like.
So what kind of a traditional boat do they compare to in terms of size, and what would you use them for?
Our smallest USV is about 6 meters or five and a half meters in length, and it's got an outboard on the back, so it's comparable to maybe if you go offshore fishing and you have a little trailer boat and you jump on and you drive it off, it's sort of comparable size and power to that style of boat. And then if we go onto our larger vessels, onto our 12 meter rib USV, then that's comparable to sort of the power and size of those search and rescue ribs that crewed versions have. So realistically, that's the size and the hull and maybe the power expectation from those vessels. There's no crewed vehicle controls for it. There's no seat in it or console in it. And then in terms of the payload, there's a large payload bay, and that really applies to what the application is. So all of our products really are multi-role, multi-purpose. So for our USVs, typically they're very good for ISR, intelligence surveillance reconnaissance missions. They can do cargo. So if you want to transport cargo over hundreds of nautical miles, or you want to do long-term, long-endurance persistent maritime surveillance, our vessels can sit out at sea. The USV has a maximum speed of between 40 and 50 knots, so it can obviously power on over to the object of interest or the vessel of interest quickly. Something we're working on at the minute is to start integrating our air vehicles as well as subsurface vehicles onto our USVs. So the USV will actually be applicable not just for monitoring and carrying out surface-based applications, but actually we'll be able to do littoral or coastline ISR missions by having a drone take off and then be able to land back onto the USV, as well as subsurface stuff. So obviously, given the geopolitical climate, the concerns about underwater infrastructure, we're actually integrating ROVs and UUVs into our USV so they can be deployed and retrieved again.
That's very interesting. I mean, would you say that you're leading the field in this domain?
That would be nice to say, but I think, to be honest, I think there's a number of amazing companies out there, you know, all spotted around the world. We're just doing our thing, putting our heads down. You know, the engineering team has done an incredible job. Mm. And realistically, what we're just trying to do is listen to end users, have a really, really close feedback loop between end user requirements and feed that straight into rapid R&D prototyping, and then feed that into mass production and low low cost mass production, so that we have that that ever evolving loop happening quickly.
And what about end user requirements in terms of weapons? You don't supply weapons, do you? But if a military buyer does want to add weapons, can they?
So in terms of weaponization, correct, we don't weaponize any of our vehicles. We always typically work with a end user as to what they, how they want to configure the vehicles. I like to use the analogy of Toyota Hiluxes, you know, standard ute or pickup, whatever you chuck in the back to do whatever you need to, whether it's a ton of sand or, you know, three of your buddies on a trip down the beach. Maybe you wouldn't put three of your buddies on one of our quadcopters, but that's a different point.
How much use could this be in Ukraine?
Lots. So Ukraine, you know, Ukrainians are building incredible vehicles at the minute. Obviously, with a huge driven demand in obviously, you know, their requirements. They're already building a number of vehicles that we are as well. So certainly they're already building a number of USVs, you know, quadcopters, the FPVs. You know, they probably have the world's largest UAV manufacturers now on a global basis. So, but certainly I think our vehicles can assist Ukrainians moving forwards.
And in the time that you've been working in this world, I mean, how quickly has maritime drone technology evolved?
They've been around for, you know, years, but where they are definitely a few years behind aerial systems, UAVs. That can be for a variety of factors, both the commercially driven point. So commercially driven, you can buy a UAV. You know, I can go down to the supermarket and buy a UAV. You can't do that with USVs. So certainly there's a commercial factor that is a lot different. In addition to that, it's actually a lot more difficult to suddenly go out and test a USV. You know, you need to find the waters, you need to have the logistics, you need to, you know, have all of the other aspects to be able to test a USV. We're in the development process. Whereas in aerial drones, again, I could pick up my little quadcopter, I could go out into the back garden and I could test the object tracking, for example. So it's a lot easier to test UAVs.
What do you think the future is? What do you want your future of your USVs to be?
The future? I can tell you where we are going with our UAVs, as I alluded to before, is really to have multi-domain capability within an entire solution. So we're not just handing over keys to a USV to be integrated into a larger system for operations. What we are looking to do is integrate our USV with UAVs, with UUVs, to have a much more powerful, much greater capability.
How close do you think we are, or that you are, to being able to do that?
We'll be doing it next month, actually. So we'll be doing some TRL-8. We'll have our TRL-8 system next month based on our current product development plan.
So that will be surface and underwater, is that right?
That's surface and air vehicle, both takeoff and landing. And we've already done a number of testing on it with different vehicles. And so we're looking to field that, obviously, yeah, within the next few weeks.
Sam, brilliant to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kate.
Mike, Ukraine's use of sea drones has arguably been one of their greatest successes in the war.
Yes, I mean, they've had a strategic victory in the western part of the Black Sea. I mean, they've accounted for about a third of the Black Sea fleet, at least numerically, and they forced the Russians out of Sevastopol, in effect, to pull the fleet right out. And, you know, what they've done, they've developed their sea baby drones. And even, very interestingly, they've been able to swarm them. So looking at some of the accounts of their attacks, particularly on the corvettes and the landing ships, which have been successful, they haven't just attacked with two or three sea babies. They've actually had a swarm of them that have attacked in groups, and some of them have held off to see what the result was, and then have attacked at the right moment. There's a report of one sea baby looking at the hole in the hull that another one had gone through, and it went through that hole that it had created in order to explode its ordnance inside the ship, which is what killed it. And in the attacks on the Boyko Towers last year, these are the oil rigs in the western part of the Black Sea, which the Russians were using as observation posts, the Ukrainians used sea baby drones, which themselves launched their own FPVs. So one drone launched its own second drone, and they attack them in that way. You know, the Ukrainians have been extremely inventive in their use of sea drones, and it's really given them a strategic victory in that part of the Black Sea. It's one of the successes they've definitely had as the war has gone on.
Keith, how advanced are the UK and potential enemies in terms of equipping themselves with USVs?
Well, I think I mentioned some of China's investments and washing up all over the Pacific regularly are an astonishing number, of undersea vehicles and surface vehicles that the Chinese are testing. So at least one potential adversary has invested significantly. To my knowledge, the Russian Navy, much less so. I mean, that could be wrong, but to my knowledge, much, much less so. For our allies, I mean, I have spent a lot of time in Japan over the last few years, and it's an area they're investing in hugely heavily, both civil and military uncrewed sea vehicles. I mean, they have a declining population. They're heavily dependent on maritime logistics. Much, much more of their freight moves by sea than by road, just around Japan's islands and up and down the country. And indeed, if there were a war in Taiwan, assuming that Japan got involved, it needs to supply Taiwan overseas. We often forget how distributed the Japanese islands are. So some of our allies are investing really heavily and see the necessity of doing so. Some of our adversaries are well ahead of us. So yeah, I think there's a lot going on, and the UK has some of the most exciting companies in that space.
Well, let's get some final thoughts now. And Keith, Mike and I talked at the beginning about the long history of uncrewed air power. Has drone technology reached full maturity yet, or does it have a lot more potential to be developed?
I think it's got huge potential. I think we're only just beginning to enter the uncrewed era. And I think in the future, as I've said, there won't be people in aircraft. It will be entirely uncrewed. And I think that future is coming much faster than people anticipate.
And Mike, we've talked many times before about military technologies that come and go, and it's about betting on the right horse to have the right thing at the right time. Is the UK right to be staking a significant chunk of money on drones and its future plans?
Yes. I mean, we're talking about drones, but it's robotics, really, that we're talking about the introduction of robotics to the whole profession of the military. And, you know, warfare will still come down to an effort of collective will. Undoubtedly, that is true. But it's also we're talking also about the return of the age of industrial warfare, that warfare that is dependent on how you can gear up your industry and deploy it to the battlefield or to an operational area. And the thing about robotics, it seems to me, is that it does change the calculus of commanders. Commanders have still got to make their decisions, but it changes the calculus as to what losses look like. You know, what can they afford? They could afford to lose robots and so on, but can they afford to lose so many robots that they can't replace them as easily as you can replace soldiers by bringing new units in? So it will alter the calculation of gains and losses and the way in which strategy has to be considered. But still, human commanders have still got to consider strategy. Whatever help they may get in future from AI, and they will, somebody has still got to carry the can for what happens.
That was really fascinating. Thank you to both of you. What a great conversation. Mike, Dr. Keith Deer, thank you for your time. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past editions of SITREP at bfbs.com/SITREP, the BFBS Forces News' YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.